Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But the next book I loved. Now, you could probably predict that I was going to love it. It's Oscar Wilde, The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh, Lord, then. You and your, that's the ultimate dandy novel.
Written only a few years before the H.G. Wells book, but infinitely superior.
Well, it's a great book.
I'd never read any Oscar Wilde before, I should say.
Really?
But, yeah, surprisingly.
I actually did read his complete work, so I mean, I don't usually do that like you do, but when I was 15, I really just, 16, I think, I just really wanted to read everything, starring with The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Well, this makes me want more. I thought immediately I knew I was going to love it. So even at the preface, it ends with "all art is quite useless." And I thought, okay, that's a good quotable moment. Let's see, you know, what this book's about. It's just full of quotes. Like, I swear, you could almost take a book quote from every page.
Well, he's a very quotable author. Like, you know, I can resist everything except temptation is one that I always use.
Yeah, and the book's full of that. You know, almost every page is something that you could quote, you know. But we have this chap, Dorian Gray, and there's this painter called Basil. And Basil wants to, he's painting Dorian, and there's Sir Henry's just their friend, or Lord Henry, actually, sorry, it is. And he's their friend, and he comes in and kind of fills Dorian with some quasi-philosophical nonsense, essentially. But Dorian's beautiful, okay? He's very, very beautiful. That's the key thing. But the conversations they have, man, Henry and Dorian, the most unnatural, ridiculous conversations walking around the garden, you know, but I loved it. I love the way they're talking. I love the fact that no real people have ever spoken like this. Like, they're talking like they're in a Shakespeare play almost. Like, I love it, you know, like, just the levels of romance. It's really doing it for me. But, you know, the plot in one sentence is Basil paints Dorian, and the painting is so perfect. And because of what Sir Henry's told him, that he's going to get old and become bitter and horrible, he fears that the painting is actually more beautiful than him. And he's going to age every minute. And obviously the painting won't. And he becomes very jealous of the painting. And at the start, they talk about whether or not Basil should show the painting, you know, in a gallery. And he says, no, I can't, because I've put too much of myself into this. Basil loves Dorian. Not a romantic love. He just he admires his beauty, you know. And he says, like, we saw each other at a party, and we both looked at each other, and, you know, across the room, and we just knew that we were meant to be together. But not in like a romantic way, again, just in this platonic, like, I'm attracted to the beauty. You're such a charismatic figure. I just need to have you in my life, and I'm going to paint you, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's all he does. And he, you know, and basically Basil never does anything as good before or after. This is his best piece. And so Henry wants it. And they say, no, you can't have it. It's Dorian's. They say, it was always Dorian's, you know, and Dorian gets to keep the painting. But Dorian reminds me a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde at times. He goes around the town doing a bit of the old swashbuckling, you know, doing a bit of getting up to some chicanery and doing a lot of bad things. And Basil starts to say, you know, how come everyone leaves the room when you walk in and you've got a really bad reputation and no one likes you and all this kind of stuff, you know? And, you know, he's just going around the town causing trouble, kind of Hyde style. And really, it turns out that he's really not a very nice person. And he's quite horrible to people. And every time he does bad things, the painting changes.
And and it just becomes uglier and uglier with all the things he does. It's really about morality, isn't it? That sometimes the things we do and the people, the way people react, can make us think, oh, right, oh, so they didn't like that. how can I do it better next time? But in his case, he just knows he can get away with murder, basically, because he wants to always be beautiful. So he does terrible things, which he wouldn't do if he didn't, if he knew that the painting were up there. And the point in painting is just getting uglier and uglier and uglier.
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept. But the curious thing is, yeah, that's a good point. You know, if he knows this is happening, why does he keep doing bad things? But it's strange. You know, he seems to not be able to resist doing them. And he just tries, he just puts the painting away at one point and doesn't want to see it, you know, because he knows he's afraid of anybody else seeing it. You know, he thinks everyone's going to see this painting. I've got to lock it up in this room where no one can see it and dismiss some of the servants and whatever. He doesn't want anyone to see this painting.
That's, and basically the painting of it is a painting of his soul.
And it's just the painting is his soul. So there's a very important detail when he sees the painting and he wants to swap. He says, I'm going to age and the painting's not. I wish it was the other way around. And somehow by magic it is. So he stays young and beautiful, almost like a vampire, almost like a kind of Monte Cristo. Mm-hmm. Like he stays the same the whole way through. And everyone else starts to, you know, they wonder, like, this guy, he looks, you know, 20 when he's 40, essentially. Like, he just never ages. But the painting is like getting old and ugly and vicious and mean looking, you know. And then he does some, I mean, he does really bad things. There's murders and things in the book, but I love this quote from near the beginning. Basil doesn't understand Dorian. He understands his own perfect vision of Dorian, but he idealizes Dorian, and Dorian's not a good chap, and Basil never realizes it. And Basil's shocked, and he says, you're not jealous of material things, are you? And Dorian says, yes, I'm jealous of everything whose beauty does not die. I'm jealous of the portrait you've painted of me. You know, and right to the end, Basil is like shocked that people don't like Dorian. Like, he just thinks that because he's beautiful, essentially, that this ancient Greek idea, actually, that beauty is tied in with morality, you know, and he just assumes that because he's beautiful, that he's good. And he's not. And at one point, Dorian meets a nice lady, and that lady's called Sylvia. Sybil Vane meets Sybil Vane. And he doesn't tell her his name, so she calls him Prince Charming, and that adds to his mystique, you know. So, but he's horrible to her. Like, he used to see her plays every night, and her plays are amazing, and she's a great actress. She's all Shakespeare, so she plays Juliet and all, you know, all the others. And he falls in love with her, but this girl doesn't really know it. She's like 16 or 17. She doesn't know anything apart from that she's been acting in the theater since she was a teen. That's what her mom told her to do. That's all she knows. So she speaks like a Shakespeare character. Like, she doesn't understand anything outside of the play. She acts every 7 nights a week. That's all she knows. And he falls in love with her, and he brings his friends to see her. The problem is, once she discovers real love, the Shakespearean love no longer seems real to her, and she's no longer able to act. And because she does a bad acting performance, he immediately falls out of love with her and hates her immediately. And she's saying, but it's because of you. And he like flings himself onto the sofa in despair. You've killed me. You've killed love. You've killed my emotions. You know, he's very melodramatic and I love it. And he can't believe that. And they're saying, you know, her mum keeps saying, you should marry him. He's a gentleman, you know. And here's an example of her speaking like a Shakespeare character. He's a gentleman. A prince, what more do you want? He wants to enslave you. I shudder at the thought of being free. I want you to be aware of him. To see him is to worship him. To know him is to trust him. And I say, Sybil, you are mad about him. I love it. She just wants to be his slave almost. Like, she's just smitten by him, you know? There's some funny moments in the book as well. It's very unclear whether he really proposed to her or not. And he says, well, I think I did propose to her. And he says, my dear Harry, I did not treat it as a business transaction, and I did not make any formal proposal. I told her that I loved her, and that she said she was not worthy to be my wife. And Harry says, well, Harry, which is, of course, Henry, women are wonderfully practical, more practical than we are. In situations of that kind, we often neglect to say anything about marriage, and they always remind us. Which I thought was very funny. But there's a bit of that in the book, and a bit of light. I guess technically it's sexism, but it's light enough to be amusing. You know, there's nothing. I mean, there's some bits where the sexism does get a little bit bad, but the stuff with Sybil's sad. You know, I'm not going to spoil what happens, but you know, she's a Shakespeare character. She has a tragic ending. You know, and Dorian doesn't care, and Basil can't believe that Dorian's just off to the theater. You know, whilst horrible things are happening to the people he loves. he's just like, well, I don't care. I'm going to the theater. You know, he's just so emotionless towards the people that he's supposed to care about. And then we do see a bit of a moral breakdown. The more it goes on, he does get worse. And I don't want to spoil what happens, but there's some really great scenes. It's a really good book. Definitely the best of the books that I've read. You know, you could tell it wasn't that keen on the other three. So that's not.
Yeah, that's a really good book. I'd recommend it, guys.
It's an amazing, amazing book. I love those type of characters. There's that ultimate lack of morality. You know, just he's very vain. He's very beautiful. And the melodramatic moments, you've killed my love, you know, just because you put on one bad performance out of 100, you know, I love it. Well, we have one more. The last book I read is called Burn the City to the Ground by Anne Daniel. This one has a lot of himself in it. The main character is called Daniel, and it is a story about a care worker and his client, Sam, and she's a quadriplegic. She's quite young. She's very vulgar. She essentially tries to disguise. I think she tries to use vulgarity, swearing, aggressiveness, sex, jokes as her shield for like her own pain and her own problems, essentially, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just their story, and COVID comes into it, and George Floyd comes into it, and a lot of political events, a lot of current affairs towards the end.
Interesting. Okay, so it's very relevant.
It's very, very relevant, and it's quite an interesting book. Ah, and hold on, cool. PJ. I think I hear the phone ringing.
I better answer it.
Let's see who's on the line.
Right.
Hey, you're through the Books Boys. You got Dean and PJ on the line. Who's calling?
Hey, this is Anne Daniel. I think you guys read my book or something like that.
Oh wow. That's it.
Yeah, we were that's literally just talking
crazy,
about it. Yeah,
that's a crazy coincidence. It's amazing that you're gone. That is mad.
How are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Just got done with the Christmas holiday. Pretty busy, pretty hectic, but I'm doing okay today.
Okay.
Got the day off. It's all good.
Awesome.
Awesome. So I read your book. I read Burn the City to the Ground. Now tell me, this is your second
book. Yeah, it's my second book. My first book is called Corners Untouched by Madness. Both books were, kind of critically praised. I mean, I'm not a millionaire. Obviously, my books aren't world famous, but both books did really well. The new book especially is doing well in Minneapolis and sort of in greater Minnesota, in the United States. And that's where the books take place. So,
Wow. So it's resonating with, the crowd. Did you write it for this particular crowd, or were you thinking that maybe the book could expand nationwide or international?
Well, I think when you write a book, though, the plan is usually for it to get as popular as possible. You know what I mean? So
yeah, yeah.
So, but it's a story about the pandemic and riots in Minnesota. Leading up to that, that's kind of the climax. So people are in, especially in Minnesota, are interested in the story. Just because it's sort of like a story about, what's been going on here,
right, relevance.
Yeah. Yeah. And George Floyd, is mentioned in it. I mean, I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. I volunteered at the shelter he was working at. Even though he's not like a huge, part of the story, it's something that's kind of going on in the background, and then also like when he is murdered, like kind of how my quadriplegic client and I that the story is about, how we react to sort of like his death and stuff like that. So people are really interested in hearing stories like that right now, and there aren't a lot right now. So I mean, I really hope that more people come forward and write sort of about these topics.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It touches on the George Floyd stuff. It touches on COVID a bit towards the end as well, you know. So we've got the story about Daniel and everything and the his patient, as you say, Sam. But then we do bring in a few different, you know, current affairs issues. And that was quite an interesting take, you know, because it's not a pure nonfiction book either. It is a novel, but we just bring in a lot of elements. And I wanted to ask you how much of this is real, you know, how much of this is based on real events.
You know, when you write, like, actually, that's probably the question that I get the most when people are talking to me about this. Mm. But you know, when you write a memoir, it's so hard to, like, it's never going to be real, you know. Mm. It's never going to be reality, because you're not going to remember, you know, conversations. You're not really going to remember, you know. I find the hardest thing is, like, the order of events and how things happen. And, mm-hmm. and you kind of want to set things up where it tells, like, a cohesive story and where there's, like, a beginning and end. And reality just doesn't really, you know, organize itself in that way all the time. So, you know, I would say it's, like, you know, probably 80% exactly what happened. Obviously there's a lot of like vulnerable adults, disabled people, so a lot of it has changed just to protect them, their identities and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's like mostly true. I mean, it's not like I just made the whole thing up. It's there are certain plot devices that I use to kind of move the story along. You know, some of the conversations in the book, I kind of wanted to use to sort of steer the narrative of the story, to touch on specific talking points that I felt were relevant. I feel like the whole idea of memoir is to share with the readership what you know, but do it in a way where they don't have to do the work that you had to do, you know? So.
Nice.
And, you know, for a memoir, like, it does, you know, it flows well. It's easy to read. It reads like a novel, you know. It reads like a story that you can easily dip into. You know, I was able to read it in, I think, 2 days, because I just, you know, I wanted to find out what was happening, and I found it very accessible to read, which is good, you know? And it's good to know that a lot of it is real. So I wanted to ask you then, right near the beginning, Daniel, I guess, you know, essentially yourself, first client he's given dies day one. Was that, you know, was that something that was, like, really difficult to deal with in the process?
Yeah, that was that, you know, it's like that happened day one in the book, but that actually happened a little later in my caregiving career. Mm-hmm. But it was so significant to me because it was the first client that I had that passed away.
Oh, wow.
So I just kind of wanted to to illustrate, like, you know, some people that are disabled don't have any family or friends or anyone visiting them. And their caregivers are the only people that are really, like, surrounding them. Mm. So that was a very true sort of part of the book that actually happened. That's exactly how it happened, but it wasn't, like, the first experience that I had. Okay. I just kind of put it in there like that to sort of demonstrate that, you know, moving into my client and caring for her, that some people don't have anybody, and they don't have support systems. They don't have, you know, family or friends coming to visit them. And that's sort of how the Samantha character in my book was, because she alienated everybody. So I just wanted to kind of have a setup where, you know, this is kind of normal for people for disabled people to be in this situation where, and I don't really say that about the client that dies in the beginning of the book. But that was very much like his story too, was that he alienated everybody in his life, and then no one wanted to visit him. And that's just the frustration of being disabled and you know, not especially like not being able to move your body if you have like a traumatic brain injury or whatever it is, you know, people tend to shy away from that. And that's sort of why I use that experience to kind of like open up the story, is just to show. And you know, that's another example of how I sort of use the memoir to kind of narrate and kind of mold the story to how I wanted people to perceive it. Because that actually happened later in my career as a caregiver. So yeah, that was real. That was all real, but it just didn't happen like at that time. Yeah,
exactly at that time. Yeah, cool. So Sam is a great character because she's always calling Daniel frat boy and, you know, shouting at him and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think she's a very, very likable character once you kind of peel off that rough exterior of mild abuse. Once you kind of get away from that.
I think, you know, everybody reacts to her differently because some people think she's like the antagonist of the book and other people like... I wanted to write her character in a way that would make people sympathetic to her because she just doesn't have a filter. I mean, she's not a bad person. She's not like, I don't think she's necessarily mean to Daniel in the book. She can seem very angry and disgruntled, but she just wants like to be taken care of properly, you know? Mm-hmm. And especially like my character is not doing his job correctly. So it's like, and I think a lot of people perceive that as her sort of ragging on Daniel as being mean to him. But I mean, being quadriplegic is awful. It's very frustrating. It's very, maddening. And I really wanted to show like sort of the human side of that and how she kind of, copes with it, and the way that she copes with it is being very inappropriate and swearing and telling dirty jokes and
a little swearing, yeah, a little sex stuff.
So it's very much like I didn't want her to be an antagonist in the book. Some people perceive her as the antagonist. I wanted to show people why she was so angry, and even in the end, as things are becoming more difficult between me and her and our relationship is becoming more toxic, it's not like we didn't care about each other. It's not like she didn't care about me. You know, it's just, that's just how it is, you know, it's like living with a roommate that you want to get along with, you want to care about, but there's just too many difficulties and frustrations. And it's not like you hate the person, but I wanted her to be like more of a sympathetic character, and I'm kind of discouraged because a lot of people are like, oh, she's the antagonist. Like she's a jerk to you. Like she's the bad guy, but that's not really how I really wanted to like write the book, with her as sort of like this aggressor, but that's just how people perceive it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And it's a very brave of you to be, well, how much is biography? How much is autobiography? We can guess, I suppose, but it seems to be very. It seems very very naked, the book. So that's very brave of you.
Yeah.
Was it your intention to talk about yourself and calling the character Daniel? Were you open to the idea? Is it supposed to be very obvious that it's you, or were you trying to sometimes hide some maybe embarrassing facts to yourself?
Well, and Daniel is a pen name, so it's all sort of meant to like kind of mask like who I am a little bit.
Yeah.
If you read my first book is even more raw and embarrassing and gritty and naked in a lot of ways. So my first book is probably even more so like stuff that I even say right in the beginning. It's like, this is all the stuff I wouldn't want a stranger to know about me. You know, okay. It says that right in the beginning of my first
book. But here it is for thousands of strangers.
Yeah. So that's just how I write. I mean, I just write about, I'm honest about what happened to me and I write about some pretty hard topics. And I just like, I have the, like privilege and the also the sort of bad luck to actually live a life that was really dramatic and worth writing about, you know. Mm-hmm. It's both mm-hmm. a blessing and a curse, but you know, that's just how it is. I think like 90% of writing is just having something to say, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you have a lot to say. There's one last little thread I wanted to pull, which is the part where Sam, so she always calls Daniel Dad, right? Because he's kind of strict and she's a bit wild and a bit crazy and he's a bit more level-headed, you know. There's the part where he finds that she's got drugs, I believe meth, and, you know, he kind of freaks out about it and she's like, well, whatever, like, you know. Was that real? Yeah. Was that bit, you know, was that something that was tough to deal with?
Real. Yeah, all the, I mean, everything that happens in the book is real. All that stuff is real.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't know. Like when I wrote it, I was like, can I get in trouble for this? Like, you know? But it's like anything, like, you know, I mean, the worst thing that they're going to do to me is tell me I can't be a caregiver anymore, I think. But, you know, it's like, that was real. And like the England Swings song, I don't know if you guys listen to that Roger Miller song, that was real. We listened to that song all the time. And I wanted to like include that in the scene where it's like England swings like a pendulum, do like when I'm giving her.
I liked when Big John came out. I liked when Big John was quoted. I love that
and
song.
Those were all songs that John. We listened to. My client and I listened to those songs all the time. So they weren't like those were songs that kind of permeated through our relationship. Because she was really That's into nice. That old music and she introduced me to a lot of it. And it's like, you know, Big John and England Swings and there's a lot of songs like that where I wanted to include them in the narrative because they were such a big part of like our relationship with each other. So that was all stuff that was, you know, that we listened to often, like when I was caring for her. And it's just kind of, I mean, they're timeless songs now. I mean, I don't know if anyone like young really listens to those anymore, but
I'm listening to Big John, but I'm not young. Yeah. So I don't know.
Well, this is, he reads a lot of, Dean reads a lot of Victorian literature, and that's what he considers a real fun time, you know?
Yeah. That's
you know, old-fashioned stuff is my bag. Oh, yeah. But let me ask you: the book has just come out a couple of weeks ago. So where can they get it?
Well, the main place people can buy it is on Amazon. I know that there's Amazon in the UK. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's that's the main place to get it. There's local bookstores in Minnesota that sell it.
Okay.
Cool. But. If you're
in Minnesota,
if you're gonna walk into the bookstore in like, you know, Leicester City or something, like they're not gonna have it. You know?
Awesome.
But we can get it on Amazon, which is, you know, where most kind of books do seem to be being sold nowadays anyway. Yeah, so that's grand, you know.
I wish it was
cool. Well, I'm glad
it was in bookstores, but it's not quite to that point yet. So
it's just easier with Amazon, yeah.
Yeah.
It is, yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you the same, we always ask everyone the same final question, and I don't give you a chance to prepare for it, but I like to know what authors are reading. So I ask if there's any book, any existing book that you wish you had been the one to write, what would it be?
Well, my favorite book is very short. It's The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. I don't know if you read it. They made it into a movie. It's like a poetry book, but some of the things that he says are so profound.
Is it from Iran or where was, I mean, I heard of the
book. Yeah. I think he was from, I want to say he was from the Middle East. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure what his background is, but they made it into like a children's movie with Liam Neeson.
Okay.
Like narrating.
Oh wow. Okay.
but it's like some of the stuff that book says, I'm like, God, I really wish that I could write like that or I wish I would have written like that. But it's like the premise behind the book is it's a prophet or it's a man that was imprisoned, and he's finally getting his leave to go back to his home country. And and all the people in the town gather around him, and he's telling them like these things about life and stuff like that. And he's like kind of expounding this this wisdom, like Jesus or the Buddha or a prophet would. And it's very beautiful. So I mean, it's not a long read. It's like more like poetry. I would definitely pick that book up because it's amazing.
It's quite a unique answer. That's good. Well, Nick, thank you very much for calling in, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. And as we said, you can get Burn the City to the Ground and now on Amazon. Right.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you
very much. You guys are awesome. Thank you.
Thanks. Too, man.
Well, that was awesome. And Daniel calling in just as we were about to talk about his book. And of course, you can get it on Amazon. So, so do check that out.
Thanks very much for calling in.
He sent me his first book too, just as to read as a PDF. Have to look at that. Yeah, haven't got around to it just yet, but that's very nice.
It's lovely.
So we're almost done. I think the only thing we have to do is our recommendations.
All right.
Now, before we get to our recommendations, I will tell everyone that if you go to booksboys.com, that's where you can find a portal to all of our episodes, all the different places that you can listen, you know, our Patreons on there, some of our other projects, links to our music on Spotify. So it's a good overall first, you know, portal to go to find out other stuff about us. PJ, I did a swindle here and I didn't tell you this, and I'm very sorry, but I've done my recommendations a little bit differently this month.
All right.
So rather than just recommending a book, what I've actually done is my top three books of the year. These are the top three of all the books that I
as well.
Yeah.
The
top three books that I reviewed on the show in 2021. Okay. So I split the year.
I'll do that too then.
Cool. I didn't give you prep time. I'm very sorry. But
no, I have to improvise.
I recorded this in video form. It's already on our Instagram. But my top three books of the year. So from the first section of the year, we did episode 5, a whole episode on Zafón, Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Mm-hmm. And it's the final one in the quadrilogy, the El Laberinto de los Espíritus, the Labyrinth of Spirits. And that's the big, long, 1,000-page one that even though it was in Spanish and it was very long, I read it in a week or a week and a half because it was just so, so amazing. So that's the Cemetery of Lost lost Books, right? De los Libros Olvidados. Cemeterio de los Libros Olvidados. And it's The Shadow of the Wind is the most famous one. It's the first one, but we did a full review of that. So that gets in my top three. And number two, around the middle of the year, I mentioned it earlier, actually, Dumas, The Count of Monte Cristo. And that, you know, it was hard. I loved all the Three Musketeers stuff, but there's so many different books there, and it's hard to pick one. Whereas Monte Cristo is just an amazing book on its own. And it's a very long book again. It's also 1,200 pages, but I absolutely love that one. One of the best books ever. And Alex was telling me it's one of his favorite books as well.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I almost forgot. It
is my number three is one of our own authors, Jonathan Edward Durham, Winterset Hollow, the one that we talked about recently.
Wow, still love to read that. That sounds very intriguing.
It was, it was so good that it actually did make it into my top three of the year. That's the one that Watership Down turns into Battle Royale, and that's all I'm going to say.
Great, great. Well, I'm going to go for, I think I read these all around the summertime as well. Well, I did read the first one, first of all, I read twice in spring, winter, spring, and summer, which is my dad's novel. Mm-hmm. Karen Burke, musician and author based in Northern Ireland. Highly recommend you see his music and his plays. But he's also got a novel, actually a third novel, which is coming out soon, I hope. And actually it's not a release date yet, so I can't say much more, but it really moved me a lot, the story. It's about Ireland. It's about his childhood at the same time. And it's also a bit of a thriller going on there, but it's philosophical. I can't say more. So I've already reviewed it. It's great. Then I would go to Mommel by Michael Ende, which we reviewed also in the summer, which is about a girl seeking a girl who's got an abundance of time and these time thieves coming to this Italian city and stealing everyone's time. And she has to basically save the world by giving the people back their time. It's essential. And it's a lovely novel, children's novel, on the philosophy of time. And it's quite scary, actually, at times, in a very philosophical way, in a very sort of weird, it's all about we ourselves are taking our own time. And these time thieves are just a metaphor. Love it. And I'd love to read it again, actually. And third of all, I was thinking Alice in Alice Adventures in Wonderland, but I think I'd have to pick Automated Alice, which is a postmodern model. Remember that one?
So it's your favorite of them.
Yeah, I think I even more than the originals, I really like this postmodern take about Alice, the real Alice of 1860, going into the future of Manchester, and as a parallel Manchester. Which is basically it's filled with these animal anthropomorphic creatures, basically, and everything's chaotic. And there's a beautiful chapter in it where she meets the author, and it sounds corny, except it's not. It's actually very philosophical, kind of a thrilling book. It's all over the place. But then there's just this kind of noon part. I think his name is Mr. Midday, and actually Jeff Noon, obviously.
Yeah,
Jeff Noon. And she meets him, and it's this quiet moment just for a second. It's such a lovely novel. It's so much fun. And really, he imitated the style of Lewis Carroll really well. And then the more time Alice stayed in modern Manchester, the more less Carroll-esque it became, and more Noon-esque. And I love that, actually.
That's really good. That's really a very good touch.
Yeah. A great ending as well. So, Automated Alice by Jeff Noon.
Awesome. Well, guys, that's our top books of 2021. That's pretty much us done. I suppose all I want to do is just to reiterate, you know, thanks to everyone listening. And you heard the big list earlier of all the stuff that we did in 1 month on Patreon. And next month there's going to be another Playboys. We're going to do The Winter's Tale, hopefully. There'll be more Dark Place Dreamers and interviews in the vault and everything else. So patreon.com/booksboys is where you can get that for less than the price of a cup of coffee. We're basically paying you at this point, you know. That's how low the prices are. We're not quite there yet. guys, that's us. In terms of the song to end with, we didn't get a chance to do a Christmas song this year like we did last year. We were too busy, but we might have something, maybe something coming up next month. So what I thought I would close with is my new song, which is In La Casa de Orense. Nice. Still haven't decided if it's any good or not. So if it's bad, I apologize. It's still relatively fresh. It's a cappella. 90% of it is. It's a kind of a doo-wop style. And it just talks about spending good times in Orense with Valerie the Pigeon Detective and so forth. So I thought I would play that. It's a short one. So we'll play that and we'll play our outro credits. And that is us. That's the last time we're going to be recording a couple of days early just because it's New Year's. So this is going to be our last recording session of 2021.
Well, hope you had a great year and we'll see you next year.
That's it. Very so we'll play the song, DJ, spin that record, and we'll be back in about a month.
See you. Ba 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 ba
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. This episode was brought to you by our sponsor,
Christmas Aristotle.
If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Max from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission.
If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys, get the show early and all of our bonus Boof Fan the Boys shows, and you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music.
Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends and come back next time for another episode of Books Boys. Read some books!
In his masterpiece, I have to put that out now. What's his masterpiece? His masterpiece is often considered... I haven't finished that book, actually, but it is pretty good. Okay.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.